All right, we're in parallel world again. Who are you?
My name's Keith Yedlin. I'm a product unit manager in the parallel computing platform team.
Excellent.
I'm David Callahan. I'm a distinguished engineer, also in the parallel computing platform team. I have lead architect responsibilities for what we're doing for parallel computing.
Excellent. Little job, huh?
Small job.
Perfect. So we've covered a lot of stuff already on Channel 9. And I hear you have some demos for us, which is really cool. But let's talk a little bit about, again, sort of the problem space that we're addressing here.
Sure.
And why all of a sudden it's a big deal? I mean, it's not like David and his colleagues haven't been working on this stuff for many years. But why is it such a big deal now, besides the fact that ManyCore is coming through?
Well, I think the big issue for the industry right now is that if we look at silicon and what the silicon vendors are actually producing, that everything is multi-core and soon to be many-core. So right now we see homogeneous multi-core processors being delivered in computers. Right now they're two-way. We already see a large number of four-way systems being sold by vendors. And people who buy those systems want to be able to leverage that power for doing productive things. And so it's a big deal for us and for, I think, ISV customers, as well as all of our line of business customers, and even regular end users, because they want to exploit the power of the machine, and we need to arm developers so that they're able to write applications that leverage that power.
Absolutely. Now, of course, you know, if we can talk about Windows for a second, I mean, the base sort of operating system that all this stuff is running on will also require changes as well.
That's absolutely right, and they come in a couple of forms. There's an underlying kernel that provides resource management and scheduling services, and we see that there's going to be some deep refactoring about how that's done. Then there's a bunch of components that are built on top of those services that provide value to developers as they compose new applications. Many of those will have to be revisited as well so that they're internally parallel, giving a degree of value to developers just for free. Use the platform, get some value. Particularly in things like media routines, where we can just go in and parallelize them and everybody gets that. It'd be great.
Agreed. Very cool. So before we continue the conversation, we've talked a lot about what's going on. We've talked about P-Link and TPL, etc., but we haven't really seen it in action. Can we check it out?
Yeah, let's go ahead and do a kind of pedal to the metal kind of run of some of the things that we're working on. Just to go ahead and position what it is that we're going to show. I'm going to show today you something on TPL, or our Thread Parallel Library. Basically, it's our imperative programming model for expressing concurrency in managed code. And then after that, I'm going to show you P-Link. And so P-Link is the next iteration of Link. It's automatically parallelized. And I'll show you how we can provide a declarative programming model for expressing parallelism in code as well.
Excellent.
So I'm going to start off with what we call our parallel morph application. And basically go ahead and open a couple of images. And so you can see right here there's an image of Katie Holmes and an image of Tom Cruise. And essentially what we're going to do is over a series of frames we're going to morph or transform the image of Katie Holmes into the image of Tom Cruise. The lines that you actually see on the images actually control the way that the transformation takes place. So I have this set up to work in several different modes. One of them is sequential and one of them is parallel. So I'm essentially just going to go ahead and kick off the serial version of the transformation. So here you can see that the first image immediately comes up because there's really no changes. And then you can see the next image just happen. And you'll see another one happen right there. If you look at the actual amount of CPU usage on this machine, we're getting about 5%. Also, you'll notice that this is a 24-way machine. And so you would expect to see a great deal more performance from this than we are with this particular version of the application. If I were to let this run through the entire thing, it would take about 2 minutes to go ahead and finish. But I'm going to go ahead and cancel it for the expediency.
Okay.
And I'm going to change this into running in parallel. And I'm going to run it again. And so you can see a much nicer experience. And you can see we've pegged the CPU at about 85%. Mm-hmm. And you can see it gets done in about 6.5 seconds. So next thing I want to show is basically, let's look at the code. Let's take a look at what we've actually done. And so most of the work for this particular application is done right here. And I'm going to turn off the highlighting, but you can basically see that we're taking the points, we're doing a comparison between them, and then twiddling the bits between them to do the transformation. You can see there's basically a nested for loop here. In the parallel version, the only line of code that we've actually changed is the first for loop, and we've inserted what we call our parallel.for programming construct. And this basically will take the for loop, partition it up into workable units, and then spread it across the available resources. This sits on top of a scheduling system we have that we call the concurrency runtime. The concurrency runtime, its whole purpose is to take the concurrency that developers have actually expressed in code, and then to map that appropriately to the available concurrency resources on the platform. That's why you saw the incredible increase in CPU usage for this particular application. So as you can see, we've gone from a experience that was not very nice into an experience that would be very usable and reasonable for an end user to use.
Absolutely.
So the next thing I wanted to show was P-Link. And so P-Link is our declarative programming model that we use for expressing concurrency. And so I'm going to bring up another application. We call this Baby Names. Now, what I just did is I produced a database of 250 megabytes of data. We actually went out to the Social Security website, and they keep a whole bunch of information about baby names and what state they were born in and what year they were born in.
Okay.
And so I'm basically going to kick off a serial query, which is going to produce a histogram of all of the babies named Robert that were born in the state of Washington between the years of 1960 and the year 2000. And you can see that that serial execution of that took about 9.32 seconds. And so now I'm going to do the exact same thing using P-Link. And you can see that that took 0.61 seconds. We get about 15.2 speed up. So let's dive into the code and take a look and see what this looks like. So here you see the two queries that we're doing. The first query is just a regular old blanket link query. So basically you see from B and babies, where the name equals the name Robert that we supplied, the state equals the state Washington, the one that we supplied, and the years between the years 1960 and the year 2000, ordered by B year and select B. Mm-hmm. And then you can see that the only thing we've changed in order to parallelize this query is we've added a method right here called asParallel. And we also provide, for the purpose of a demo, a overload for this particular method, which allows us to specify the number of processors that you could actually use.
Very cool.
It is very cool and very easy for developers to use.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the key thing here is that there are still situations where developers can get themselves into trouble when using these kinds of constructs. For example, if within the where clause there was some kind of delegate which changed the state of the set that was being enumerated across, that would present a race condition or a problem for the developer. And so we provide the as parallel now as an opt-out strategy. But eventually, we believe that we're going to be able to infer from the query whether it's a safe query or not, and be able to do this more implicitly than we're able to do it today.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, it seems like because of what was used to implement Link, that should be possible. I mean, there's functional constructs in there, right? Closures,
yeah,
and various
absolutely.
Other things. So it should be possible to have a smarter compiler figure that out, yes?
It should be possible. And the trouble is the boundary between where the Link semantics specify the behavior of the where clauses, the select clauses, and their interaction with what the developers provide in the form of delegates.
Yes.
Historically, they've been completely unconstrained. And in a sequential world where you're going to run through the same sequence every time, you can dig into it, you can figure out what's going on. But in a parallel world, if there are any strange behaviors in those delegates, A, it's hard to predict the order in which they're doing. They're going to be done in interleaved order. And it's hard to guarantee that that same order will be done again. That makes the debugging problem tough. It makes the testing problem tough. So these are all areas where traditional sequential models start to meet new higher-level models. You start to have these sort of problems to work for. And this is an area where we're actively working in, trying to figure out what are the right guardrails to build to make it easy to sort of plug things into a parallel link and also keep you out of trouble when you do that.
Absolutely. I mean, so we've been covering the sort of the concurrency problem for a while now, beginning with the discussion with, I haven't talked to him for so long, I can't remember his name. He runs all of research. He's one of those super high guys. Craig Mundy, yes. And it's interesting because there's sort of two camps. Not that I know what camp he's in, but there's those that say, we've trained people to think sequentially as programmers anyway over the last 20 years. And we provided them with all these tools, which essentially makes writing parallel code hard, which is why you guys are doing what you're doing. So there are those that say, just throw that away and teach programmers to use new tools. So, for example, start writing in purely functional languages, which is sort of unrealistic. Then there's the camp that's like, well, we can do both. But do you see, I really would like to know, do you think that you're going to be able to solve this problem by adding a bunch of the stuff into the already existing tool set? Clearly that's the path you're going down, but you know that it's, so you're convinced that it's the right thing to do. That's my question.
There are many problems you try to solve. One is, how do we effectively build robust and scalable applications, realizing where we are in terms of the skill sets of developers, the basic infrastructures we're trying to build on? How do we move all that forward? Mm-hmm. So typically we take a strategy of identifying what good practices are like, adding tools to let you build applications in a style that we believe is correct, deprecating practices that we found in the past to not be very good, and using developer tools of various forms to help you move from one to the other. So yes, we'd like to give you perfectly safe tools. That would require a complete rewrite of the infrastructure on up. So instead, we'll give you strong, effective tools and guidance on how to use them. And we'll also provide you perhaps perfectly safe tools, so where they fit, you have an opportunity to leverage them, but you don't have to throw out what's come before. So in the parallel link case, for example, most link queries are safe and parallel. There are some risks, and one of the things we're doing as our next step is to help clearly identify those risks so that you know when you might be getting into trouble, and therefore carve out safer and safer, more productive bubbles over time, sort of a crawl, walk, run strategy.
Sure.
We also believe that you should have stronger compositional tools, that right now your program is one big mess. There's no good way to carve it into pieces and let those pieces talk to each other in an effective and safe manner. Mm-hmm. So we'd like to add those tools. Within a piece, you have the traditional models. So you have ways to carry knowledge, understanding, and artifacts forward, but now you have a stronger compositional model to glue them together. Mm-hmm. The model we're pursuing there models what's used on the web, a service-oriented model where you talk through messages that are asynchronous in character. So that's a new compositional model of similar things. Within each one of those pieces, we can do things like P-Link to give you a safer data parallel style to sort of pick that low-hanging fruit there. So there's a lot of things we can do in this space, and we're trying many of them.
Excellent.
Yeah, ultimately, I think that you're going to see us approach the problem from both ends. We have a large developer base that has millions and millions of lines of code, and all of them want to be able to go ahead and exploit the power of the platform with their existing code. So the things that you see us providing now are kind of some of the low-lying fruit things that we knew that we could provide that would provide some immediate relief. Mm-hmm. But we know that in the long term, there's a lot more for us to do. And I mean, this is a lot of what David was referring to. Mm-hmm. The things that provide an isolation model that will go ahead and provide for easier and safer development of parallel code. This is one of the next ideas that we're going to be focusing on and delivering to customers in the future after we are able to go ahead and deliver our current technology.
Mm-hmm. So just to like jump into the fun stuff out and way out in the future, and I'll point this at the distinguished engineer here. Do you think we'll be able to have a world where we'll be able to build virtual machines that are smart enough to figure out, you know, when to parallelize sequential code?
No. I say that with a certain amount of confidence, particularly if you mean the sequential code, the code base we have today.
Yeah.
This was actually a problem I worked on. This was my PhD work 20-some years ago.
Excellent.
And the first job I had was sort of to take that into practice. And even in the sort of narrow confines of sort of technical computing and Fortran and arrays, the problem was undecidable in theory and unassailable in practice. And that's not a viable strategy moving forward. So we look much forward to changing the basic model, giving you the right tools to express the parallelism, and then try to automate some of the problems underneath. So in Keith's example, we're still relying on the programmers today to identify where the parallelism is, but then we take over. In all of these models, there's no notion of how many processors you're dealing with, how you acquired them, how the individual pieces of work get mapped onto those underlying processors. Those are areas we believe the system can automate. And it's important to automate them because in large, complex applications, no single programmer, no single component understands the environment it's running into. You must automate the resource and load balancing problems. That's part of what we have concurrency runtime for. It's part of our conversations with the Windows Core team about how to sort of refactor resource management. Yeah, up and down the stack, this problem has echoes.
Absolutely. Very interesting.
Yeah, it's great stuff. It really is. It's very exciting work. It's all very much bleeding edge. It's been a hard problem to solve. The funny thing is that the stuff that we're doing isn't rocket science. There just wasn't a lot of motivation to get it done in the past. But now with all the multi-core and many-core systems which are being produced, the motivation is really there.
Absolutely. And, you know, do you run into problems with this stuff when you... because many-core machine could mean that it has not just the typical style of CPU execution cores, but it could be GPUs on there as well. You could have that sort of weird, you know, asymmetric, you know...
You absolutely could.
Yeah.
In fact, some of the earliest of what we call many-core machines, and you know, we tend to use that to mean more than eight cores. The earliest ones we may see on the desktop are exactly that. The functionality of the GPU is brought onto the same silicon area, and it's that computing resource, somewhat generalized, that we try to apply. Our team's initial focus has been on multi-core homogeneous systems. Because there's both an opportunity, there's more power, but there's also a problem in that traditional programming has flattened out. You're not going to get any faster. It used to be, you write a piece of code, and you know, for years and years, as it scaled up on problem sizes, the hardware just kept up. Now, that code that you wrote 10 years ago, it's going to stop scaling, even though the problems you're going to try to apply it to get even bigger and bigger. We've seen this in the media. We've gone from, you know, half a megapixel cameras to 7 megapixel cameras to HD media. And if computers had just gotten faster and faster, they would have kept up with that. But now we're at this inflection where single stream, single thread processing isn't any faster. We have to go parallel. So that's sort of the stick to go with the carrot of other opportunities. I launched into that and I forgot what the initial question was.
Well, the initial question was just about the asymmetric cores.
So,
chipset.
As we go parallel, we'll also have this opportunity to retune the hardware to a different workload. The sort of current processors you buy from Intel and AMD have been carefully tuned over years and years at running sequential code. And that's going to change. They'll now be, as we develop parallel workloads, they'll start re-engineering to those workloads. They'll engineer for power management in a throughput setting instead of ultimate performance single thread. And so that will be an interesting change. And I think one of the things that will lead to is an asymmetry in the processors. So by asymmetry, I mean same basic instruction set, two different implementations. Still have a big, fat, out-of-order processor like we have today. So the legacy code still runs at speed, that complex OS code still runs good, but then a lot of smaller cores, perhaps optimized for parallel computations. Whether this then subsumes the GPU workload or simply is another tool, we don't know that. Our initial investments have been on getting 2, 4, 8 cores to work well in a very general purpose, very rich, very heterogeneous kind of workload. But we also recognize that there will be a data parallel workload that emerges. Right now it's all in graphics, but it's trying to break out of graphics and do other things. Mm-hmm. And we'll want to cater to that over time as well. Currently in the DirectX team, they started this process in DX9. They added programmable shaders. And looking forward, they're going to add additional ability to use GPUs as data parallel compute engines. And so we work with them and we talk about how should those two threads merge in the future and give developers a common set of tools mm-hmm. for what is really a similar set of problems.
Excellent. And so they don't even think about, you know, if it's targeting a GPU or CPU. They just think at the abstraction layer that you provide them.
That's right. And, you know, one of the great strengths of the DirectX is it completely abstracts the underlying hardware layer. It doesn't matter who the GPU manufacturer is, as long as you're sort of working in that graphics special domain, they take care of mapping it down onto the hardware. And this has allowed a very rapid innovation, both at the hardware and then over time as those APIs have emerged. And yet developers are insulated from all that churn to a first approximation, and that's great. We'd love to do something similar as we see similar innovation in the data parallel sides of the CPUs. We don't really know, you know, how far we can take the models that are emerging for additional visual computing kinds of things, mm-hmm. how far they'll move into other domains. Can we do XML processing with it, for example? We don't really know where that boundary is, so it makes sense to invest, but invest in both sides so that we have the space covered and it's needed.
Yeah, absolutely. Very interesting. And you guys don't think this stuff up in a vacuum. I mean, you work with the hardware companies, right?
Oh, yeah. We're working obviously very closely with all the hardware companies, the Intels, the AMDs, the NVIDIAs, et cetera. Certainly understanding their plans and the directions that they're heading, but also understanding how they see their silicon evolving and the things that they're actually really worrying about. There's David mentioned power management. I mean, it's
absolutely
one of the biggest issues that's going to come up related to effectively leveraging the power of multi-core CPUs, especially like on laptops and ultra-mobile systems. Mm-hmm. So this is something I think that the hardware companies are going to focus on for long periods of time. I mean, David brought up the work and investigations we're doing around GPGPU. One of the key reasons for looking at that work is really the efficiency per watt. I mean, in some situations, especially with data parallelism, you're going to get much better efficiency by going ahead and being able to leverage GPGPU to solve some of these problems than you would the generic CPU that's on the system. And so the tasks for us are really to go ahead and provide tooling and programming models that make it easy for developers to identify where is it best to go ahead and target those things, along with the best practices so that they're successful in doing so.
So one of the things that I've noticed since, again, we've been pushing this that there's a problem for a while now, ever since Herb Sutter wrote that paper that in Dr. Dobbs'
about
journal.
The end of the free lunch.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the first thing we did was like, hey, let's go talk to Herb, figure out what, you know, what's going on here. But if you look at the popularity of what's most on developers' minds right now, as far as Microsoft developers, it's what's new for C#, right? That's like top of mind. And when you start getting into the parallelism stuff, it's further down the list. And so, you know, that's kind of what I'd like to address just briefly. I mean, what kind of feedback are you getting from developers? If developers don't seem that worried, sort of like smoking, right? At some point it's going to kill you, and you know it, but you'll keep doing it. Parallelism could be like, well, they're not out yet, I'm not going to worry about this, whatever, they'll figure something out. You know, they'll be able to solve lung cancer, so I'll keep smoking. Let's, you know, address that briefly.
Yeah, so, you know, it's really funny because we see broad interest in a subset of the developer marketplace. So, for example, HPC developers, scientific development, academics, all of them are interested in this problem domain now. Mm-hmm. ISVs, who are trying to differentiate their product, they're interested in this problem domain now because it actually offers an opportunity for them to go ahead and deliver additional value. I mean, Microsoft isn't the only company that has this value chain cycle where we add value to our product in order to go ahead and try and generate customer demand for the features that we provide. Mm-hmm. All of the ISVs have a similar business model. And certainly, if there's an opportunity for them to leverage the power of ManyCore to differentiate their product and to deliver new experiences, mm-hmm. they're going to want to leverage that. It's a revenue chain opportunity for them. From the line of business developer, I think there hasn't been a lot of interest in this now because there are other problems that those particular segments are focused on. But very soon, they will begin being interested in this kind of technology. And we, as I demonstrated, for example, in the P-Link example, especially in the areas related to analytics and data analysis, reporting and report generation, these technologies are going to end up leading to reductions in the amount of time that it actually takes to produce reports and the amount of time that it takes to make decisions in the business. Mm-hmm. So it's going to end up adding value to the bottom line. And so we know that long-term it's going to be a broader issue. Developers, you know, we always have a tendency to look at things in a stovepipe. The big things that seem to be going on right now are software plus services. And so a lot of developers are really interested in that particular stovepipe. But developers, there's also a series of things that are happening around the edges, and developers have to go ahead and pay attention to all of those things, else they end up getting left behind. And so this is just our attempt to go ahead and get this technology out in front of them, let them go ahead and use it, let them provide us with feedback about how it helps or how it doesn't, so that we can iterate a few times and provide the programming models and infrastructure they need to be successful.
Interesting. Now, what about in the company, right? So what about, you know, the CLR team, for example, could leverage this this framework, at least in the unmanaged side, right? I mean, they're going to have, the CLR is going to have to run on 80 cores. Maybe it could load up faster. Maybe it could.
So if we think about the CLR, there's a couple of ways to think of it. One is it's a big, complicated, already parallel application, right? It provides a virtual machine to services above it. Mm-hmm. We have pretty serious experts in that team who understand and have for years these sort of deep low-level problems. Mm-hmm. And they're, it's sort of already a closed book for the CLR itself.
Sure.
And mostly we're worrying about, okay, how about application developers who are sitting above mm-hmm. that fundamental engine? What tools can we provide them? And there is a spectrum of developers here mm-hmm. from those that are looking for really high impact. They need, have a job, they want to get it done pretty quick. They're looking to Microsoft to provide a bunch of really key components and a way to compose those components rapidly together to put something in the field. And then there are more expert developers who are going to want to build and think about those components and are the component providers. It's quite a gamut. And it's certainly the case that those top level, those high productivity, who are probably the largest volume of the developer market, we want to insulate them from all of the headaches and give them dead simple things to do, pretty much what they have today, and parallelize under the covers. Mm-hmm. Perhaps provide new frameworks, new engines that they can plug into and get the value without having to be aware of it.
Exactly.
But somebody has to write those engines, and we have to lay the plumbing to get those engines built. And in some, in many ways, that's the path we're on.
Yeah, I think another interesting point is that when we take a look at how we think mainstream developers will leverage parallelism, a lot of it, we believe, will be through encapsulated parallelism in the system. So, for example, frameworks, libraries that actually provide parallel implementations where the developer doesn't really need to know how to go ahead and write the parallel implementation. They can just leverage it at the API level. And so you also see across the company a lot of focus on how we will go ahead and deliver those implementations and encapsulated parallelism to our customers.
Excellent. Very cool.
There's also a broader desire in the company to raise the semantic level at which people work and to let them, instead of writing a lot of code, work in frameworks where they talk about rules. Here are the business rules that apply, and I'll express those in sort of non-sequential forms. And if I talk at that level, A, I open the door to less sophisticated people who have no training in programming per se, but can understand business logic and ways to express it. And then I've put them in a framework where there can be implicit parallelism under the covers they don't even know about. And one of the trends that Microsoft has provided to the software industry is to try to democratize capability, to get it in the hands of more and more users in various ways. Mm-hmm. There are administrative assistants all over the country that program Outlook by putting in the rules that filter through messages. That's a style of programming. They don't think about it as programming. They don't do it procedurally, mm-hmm. but there's all these ways to engage people to let them get devices to do what they want. That's programming, and under the covers, we hope to have parallelism in all those layers. A long process.
Absolutely. You're going to be very busy.
We.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
Keith,
sure.
The audience, we're busy.
But I mean, it's an interesting thing because, for a little bit of transparency here as to, because Channel 9 is also about humanity and people that work here. I mean, as a distinguished engineer, you're sort of in the upper tier along with technical fellows. It's like, we are the keepers of the cloth of technical stuff at Microsoft. You guys get together and like chat about this across the company? Do you have meetings? Any arguments?
We actually do. As you may know, David Vaskovich, CTO, who is very top of mind about how to manage the technical computing networking within the company. He even has a sort of a forum he calls that technical computing network. Tries to drive discussions on various topics. There is a collection of quests. Have you talked about quests at all?
I don't think we have. I don't know whether or not those are publicly disclosed.
The fact that we have quests is public. There are statements of our aspirations as a company from a technical level, where we want to go over a multi-year time frame.
Yeah.
I own the quest on parallel computing.
Right.
And it focuses on the technologies, the problems we're going to try to solve, how we stage those problems over time. But those are mostly technology kinds of aspects. Anders owns a quest on the evolution of languages, for example, which actually intersects mine at a pretty core level. In your interview with Anders recently, he talked about concurrency being the elephant in the room for programming languages.
And
it's good to see mainstream programming language experts sort of start thinking about these problems. And so part of my job is to sort of encourage those conversations.
Sure.
Right. And so it's interesting to see the interactions or interdependencies between the quests, because the quest that Anders is working on has many dependencies on the quest that David is working on, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. In addition, I think that my role, along with the many other managers at Microsoft, and I think you talked with Steve Tashira yesterday and Sean Nordberg, is to go ahead and execute on mapping or taking the strategy and vision in the quest and delivering it as value to our customers. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of us who are very busy trying to go ahead and help realize the vision that David and Anders are actually setting forth.
Absolutely. And I just point out, the other guy in the room with Anders was Guy Steele.
Yeah.
And Fortress is so concurrent that they make it difficult for you to even write sequentially.
Yeah.
That's so, one way to go.
I watched that interview. It was kind of fun. I've known Guy for a number of years. There were Fortress came out of an interesting process that I was actually involved in. Prior to coming to Microsoft, I was at Cray Inc., a supercomputer manufacturer.
Oh, nice.
And we actually had a competing language process involved. So Sun and IBM and Cray were all part of a big DARPA-funded activity, and that was one of the initial sparks behind the new language efforts. Sun's Fortress language has gotten, I think, the biggest traction. Not surprising, Guy Steele is like one of the top three experts in language design sort of in history, and having him as a as the wood behind that error has been phenomenal. And he's gotten to explore not just concurrency, but a lot of interesting language efforts to sort of step beyond where he got to work in the Java framework. At Cray, we worked through a language called Chapel, Cray High Performance Language. And IBM had a progress project called X10, which is still around. Vivek Sarkar down at Rice is working on that. So the government was looking forward to specifically at very high-end, petascale kinds of systems. How are we going to program that? And so parallelism becomes just the be-all and end-all in that space. And a lot of those ideas now get to trickle down to the desktop and, in fact, go mainstream through it. So it's an exciting time for those of us that have kind of been in the business for a while.
Right on. Well, hey, man, thank you for coming on Channel 9. And yeah. This is yet another great conversation about this problem.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming and talking to us.
Sure.
Thank you, Joe.
Yeah, all righty. Well, good luck, you guys, and we'll talk to you as you progress. We'll follow it.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Cool.